Blog Talk Radio.
This is Rare Bird Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, L.A. poet, performer, musician, author of the poetry collection Eighth and Agony, out on Punk Hostage Press, and you are listening to Poetescape. Welcome, everyone, on this fine first Sunday of June. With me today is Jennifer Joseph, founder and publisher at Manic Depress in San Francisco. How are you, Jen?
I'm good, Rich. How are you doing?
Doing well, thanks, and thanks for being on the show. Founded by Joseph in 1984, Manic D's titles include fiction, nonfiction, art books, poetry, with titles diverse as The Civil Disobedience Handbook, Happy Punks 123 Accounting Book, Good Advice for Young Trendy People of All Ages, and In Me Own Words, The Autobiography of Bigfoot. Manic D represents a diverse group of unique writers and artists with emphasis on those who have been shunned by the traditional publishing establishment for lacking commercial viability, regardless of their talent or future promise. Jen, can you talk about the origins of Manic D, its philosophy, and what you look for in a manuscript?
Manic D started in 1984, before books needed barcodes and stuff like that. It was before the prevalence of desktop computers. So I started Manic D because, my mom was friends with a big shot literary agent in New York, and she arranged a meeting with me. I was 22 or 23, and I gave him some of my poetry to read, and he was like, "Forget about it, kid. New York publishers don't really publish poetry anymore unless you're really famous. And, manuscripts are read by the marketing department before the editorial department nowadays." And this was more than 25 years ago. So good luck. Take up stamp collecting. And, he didn't say take up stamp collecting, but, you'd be sooner hit by a meteor than get your poetry published by a New York house. So because of my personality, I generally, if somebody says no to me, it means, okay, go for it. So I was living near City Lights Bookstore and spending all my time sitting in there reading. It was in San Francisco in the early 80s, there was an opportunity to be slack. It was we had cheap rent and didn't have to work full time. It was a really good place to be pursuing some kind of artistic project. So I took it upon myself to sit in City Lights and actually study their books and how they were made and how they were laid out and what the covers looked like. And I got a book published by a small press called The Publish It Yourself Handbook. And that was put out by the Pushcart Press, who are best known for the Pushcart Prize. So I read that book. Back then, ISBNs were free. Now they cost $800 for a block of 100, I think. But you got a block of 100 for free. So I followed the instructions in the Publish It Yourself Handbook and subsequently put out the first Manic D book, which was a book of my own poetry called The Future Isn't What It Used to Be. And
nice.
Yeah. The cover was by my good pal from college, Tamar Cohen, who's still a fabulous designer and artist, and my pal Julia, who lives in L.A., Julia Schachter, helped me do the layout at the kitchen table. And then we sent the boards off to a book manufacturer in Michigan who is not in business any longer. And I think the retail price of the book was $3.50. which was the going price for poetry paperbacks at the time.
And what are they now?
About $15.
Yeah, yeah.
And distribution was what I call the hoof and woof method, which is you walk into a store and say, can I put some books on consignment? So the first places that the first Manic D book was sold, we were bi-coastal. We had them in City Lights, a bookstore in San Francisco, and in St. Mark's Books in New York City, which actually was on St. Mark's Place at the time. Yeah. And, every 6 months I'd go in and collect my, $5.40 and restock the books.
What was the breakthrough for you where things really started to change for Manic D in regards to, just the really small scale of things to where you started to see, wow, things are really changing here for us?
Well, it wasn't, that all of a sudden things were changing. As you know, I put out a couple of books in the 80s. I decided after I did my first book that I actually really liked publishing. It was fun making books. I really, really enjoyed it. For some reason, it struck a chord. And so I guess we put a listing at Manic D Press had a listing in like the small press directory, which was, back then it was like everything was print. There was no digital. So I started getting manuscripts from other people, and so I got a great manuscript from David Jewell in Austin, Texas. So the second Manic D book was Lizards Again. David Jewell is still around and still doing great projects. I guess he's best known for having a poem featured in the Richard Linklater film, was it Before Sunrise, I think? The one with Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. Anyway,
yeah.
And so we put out his book, and that was a really fun project. But, and then I kind of got distracted. I was in a rock band called The Furies, as you know, Rich Ferguson.
Yes.
And so,
in fact, we're going to play Fun Around the World a little later on.
Oh, how great is that? Very
yeah,
fun.
I was
and
able
so,
to track down a copy.
More power to you. How fun is that? I'm telling you something. It's a riot. I 25 years ago, I'm all for it. But anyhow, so... Basically, when the Furies disbanded, it occurred to me that it would be that it's easier to grow old more gracefully in the book world than it is in the rock and roll world. And I'd been doing poetry all along, and as you know, putting on readings and shows. Remember the 10-minute show? What was the name of that club?
Oh yeah, at the
it wasn't
oh,
the Chatterbox. Okay, it's called Amnesia on Valencia Street now. Before it was Amnesia, it was a Chatterbox. And before it was a Chatterbox, it was the... What the heck
It'll
was the name of that
me,
place?
Yeah.
Anyway, that club is still there. They're still putting on shows. But anyway, so that I was... I put on poetry readings at Fort Mason as part of the Poetry Film Workshop run by Herman Berlant. We had the Young Poets series there. So I'd always been... And we had did a poetry a lot in the rock band, too. So it was, I had continued to do that. Anyway, so I just decided that, playing music was awesome and a great amount of fun in my 20s, but moving forward, if you have to pick a topic, I decided to just, pursue the publishing thing. I decided at that point that the key thing was distribution, and, our first distributors, we started signing up with distributors in the late 80s. We put out a third book called Greatest Hits. Rich, you're in that one, aren't you?
Not sure, actually.
Okay, because I'm not sure if you were. It's like I can't remember who was when. I know Dashka Slater was in there, Steve Silverman, Blake Nelson, who went on to be, a fabulous young adult writer. That was one of those wacky little things. And, so that was an anthology of people from that Young Poets series at Fort Mason. And so that came out in 89, I think. So we had three titles under our belt, and signed up with Small Press Distribution in Berkeley, and Last Gasp as well. And then we started, once we had a little bit of distribution, I started going to what's now called the BEA. Back then it was the ABA. It was originally the American Booksellers Association Convention, and it was a trade show. And as we put out more and more books, then we put out Bricks and Anchors by John Longhi in the early 90s, in 1990 maybe, or 91. And then Graveyard Golf and Other Stories by Vampire Mike Cassell, with a cover by S. Clay Wilson. And in 89, I started doing the Poetry Above Paradise readings, which were every Sunday night. And
that's a great reading series.
Yeah, that was crazy. It was crazy good because it was really, because of it being every Sunday night, it really attracted some great, great writers. And a lot of the people who, you know, I watched people's work evolve, and some people were just dynamite. And, you know, we started doing chapbooks for people, which they could sell themselves and make some money at the readings. And it was a very, very active literary scene in San Francisco in the 90s. And some writers who were pretty well known, like, I guess, Michelle T. and Beth Lissick and Stephen Elliott, all these folks got their start, you know, as part of the San Francisco literary scene in the early 90s. And so we published a bunch of those people. And then at one of those conventions, I can't remember which one, maybe it was the Northern California Independent Booksellers Association convention, I went up to a guy who had, like, kind of hair down to his shoulders. He had kind of long hair. He was wearing a flannel shirt. I just thought he was, like, you know, some, you know, guy who worked, you know, and I was going up to distributors and asking if they could, you know, sign us up for distribution. And so I think we just put out Mobius Stripper by Baina Witt, which is was a great, great book. And I went up to him. I showed him our books. And I was like, we're looking for distribution. He's like, well, you know, keep in touch with me. Here's my business card. And it turned out to be Charlie Winton, who is head of Publishers Group West, which PGW is really a great, huge distributor. And he's like, keep in touch. And I was like, wow, I was just talking to the head of the company like he was, you know, one of us, you know. I didn't realize that he was the guy who was in charge. But anyway, I did keep in touch. And Lollapalooza was a big deal in the early 90s. And Perry Farrell, who founded Lollapalooza Music Festival, came to Last Gasp. Last Gasp was going to be the book vendor who goes on tour with them. When he came into Last Gasp, John Longhi gave him a pile of Manic D books and was like, here, check these out. It's a small press in San Francisco. And there was a front page article in Spin magazine with Perry Farrell on the cover talking about Lollapalooza. And the interviewer asked him what he was reading. And he said, I'm reading Mobius Stripper by Baina Witt, and it's like the best book I've read in years. And he was going on and on and on about how amazing this book was. And it was the cover story in Spin, which was a big deal back in the early 90s, you know.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
And anyhow, so we didn't have distribution, and it was a heartbreaker because after that article came out, we were getting a million phone calls from bookstores like, where can I find this book? And I went back to Charlie Winton at PGW. I was like, dude, you have to distribute our books, you know? We're getting the publicity. And we were able to, you know, work out a deal. And he took a chance on us and signed us up for distribution, a national distribution in 1994. And,
nice.
I got to quit my day job and do it full time.
Yay. Well, sort of along those lines, you know, you're a homespun operation. I believe you're the only paid employee and you're armed with a couple of interns. You read all the manuscripts you receive, even unsolicited ones. You've
embraced
everything.
Yeah, well, I mean, everything is unsolicited. Let's put it that way. I mean, you know,
right.
I don't ask people for manuscripts.
Okay. And,
I don't deal with agents if I can help it.
Okay,
so,
yeah, I was wondering about that.
Direct from writers. Anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt, Rich.
No, that's okay. So you've embraced everything from paparazzi and porn screenwriter tell-alls to alternative travel guides. You mainly publish books most commercial publishers wouldn't touch. All this, and you still receive award after award from, you know, all corners of the literary world. I'm curious, how is it that you're able to remain so popular and stay in business after almost 30 years?
That's an excellent question. I'm wondering that myself, Rich, actually, on a daily basis. It's like, huh? What was that? So, you know, it's one of these things where, you know, I feel very blessed. You know, I've been really, really lucky. And I have to, you know, here's the thing. You know, a lot of writers don't understand this. It's just like, okay, they think, okay, my name's on the book. It's all about me or I did this. It's like what writers don't understand is there's like 1,000 people in the background helping to get their work in front of readers, you know, and they're the unsung heroes of the culture, of the entire culture. Is, you know, we're cultural workers, and where you know our names are on books. You know, I mean, Manic D right now, you know, for the last 6 years, 7 years, whatever the heck it is. Is distributed by Consortium. We left Publishers Group West just before they went bankrupt and the whole thing went to shit. I mean, they're back in business now and they're doing just fine, but there were some issues there. But anyway, but we got out in time, so we didn't lose any money on the PGW bankruptcy. We had another distributor in place, and Consortium's been great. You know, the thing is this. You know, there are sales reps that go to meet with the book buyers at bookstores. They present our books. They say, this is really good, and this is what's good about it, and this is why you should carry it, and you should read it, and tell your customers how good it is. And, you know, those people are the unsung heroes, the sales reps who go to the book buyers who stock the stores, the people who work in the bookstores and read it and put a little shelf talker on it that says, hey, you know how they have the staff picks. I read this book. It's really good, and here's why. If you like this, you'll like this. And, you know, these people are all – this is all part of the mix. And, you know, nobody's making lots of money, you know. Nobody's right. Getting famous, but it's just a whole thing that if for the joy of doing it, you know, to keep moving the culture forward. And you know, for me, you know, for some reason people send us good writing, you know, and we get a lot more writing than we can publish, but at the same time I feel very fortunate they've always had something show up that's like, you know, this I'm lucky because if things appeal to me, they often appeal to other people. And I can't say, you know, when you ask what manuscripts you're looking for, I don't look for manuscripts. They look for me. And sometimes mm-hmm. they find me. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so. You mentioned before the Furies and a great, great band, I must say. I have one of your songs. Jungle Book, Mark Gunyan and Jim Hoadley, I was able to track down a copy of Fun Around the World, and I would love to play that and then ask you a couple questions about the Furies and then get back to Manic D Press.
Sure, absolutely, Rich. That's fun.
All right, cool. All right, this is Fun Around the World by the Furies.
Yeah!
And that was Jen Joseph with The Furies. I just love that song. It was funny, you know, because I just listened to it the other day after I was able to track it down and just like, you know, that song still holds up. It's just still so much fun. Jen, do you have any a fun Furies story, you know, maybe when you were touring or anything that you care to share?
Well, you know, it's one of these things where I think that, you know, The Furies was an amazing project, and it was super fun, you know, writing songs. I mean, you could totally hear the influence of Jonathan Richman, you know.
Yeah.
And I wrote that song with my friend Tamar Cohen, who did the cover of the first Manic D book, who's still my good friend and a wonderful artist. And, you know, it's just one of these things where I just have total respect for that part of my life. It was an amazing experience, and also just an amazing community. It was a great time to be in a band in San Francisco. Rich, you were in the band Blue Movie,
yeah.
And the Furies played with Blue Movie a lot. And, you know, and there was a whole crew of people who all played gigs with each other and enjoyed each other's music, the Catheads, the Donner Party, the Maguires. You know, we just had a fun time. We went to each other's barbecues, you know. You know, we laughed together, we cried together. It was just
yeah.
And the Muskrats. I mean, it was just really, really an amazing time. And, you know, the cultural, it was about participation. It wasn't like anybody was a big rock star. It was just fun to be part of it. It was fun to be engaged. It was, you know, the doing, you know, and the being were much more fun than anything. Just doing it, you know, just being part of it. And, you know, I just adore, you know, that I had that opportunity that, you know, I mean, the Furies came together. I was my day job at that point. I was raising money at a place that helped battered women, and another gal who worked there. You know, I was carrying my guitar. I'd been jamming with people at some point, and she's like, "Oh, I play drums." I was like, "Really? We should get together and jam." And that was Debbie Tenorino, the original drummer in the Furies. So I kind of met her through this wacky job. And then we started asking around, did anybody know a bass player? And I can't remember who. I mean, I think Debbie ran into somebody who knew Maggie Emenheiser. And she was a phenomenal musician, really phenomenal. And so, you know, the three of us would jam. Debbie had a pet boa constrictor. We'd play at Debbie's house on Fell Street, her apartment on Fell Street. And she had a pet boa constrictor, like a 6-foot-long snake named Snookums.
I lived there for a period of time.
Do you remember Snookums? Do you remember Snookums?
Oh, yes.
And we'd be rehearsing. And I'm telling you, I'd be barefoot. And all of a sudden, I'd feel something tickling my foot. And the snake would come out because it felt the vibrations through the floor. And I would be like, you know, oh, good gravy. I can't, you know, Snookums, please. You know, I'd like, okay, well, let's take it from the top.
One, two, three, four.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember one time Deb was having these art classes at her house, and one day when I was living there, she asked if I could like be an art model, and she convinced me to do this Johnny Appleseed thing where I wore a soup pot over my head and had no clothes on at all. Only in San Francisco. Anyway.
That's what I'm talking about. It was just like, you know, it was just wackiness, you know, and but it was fun.
Yeah.
It was all in good fun, you know. That's the whole thing, and you know, so you know, it was an interesting crew, and you know, we had fun rehearsing and we had fun playing gigs, and we'd play, you know, fun shows outside and inside, and you know, it was just fun to play, and. You know, it was fun making a record. Of course, you know, times change. We put out a record, and within 2 years, everything had switched over to CDs, and, you know, it was the last of the vinyl. But, you know, when it was time to tour, Debbie had kids, and so she couldn't go on tour. So Linda Champagne, who I'm still pals with, was a DJ at KUSF, and she was going to San Francisco State. And she was helping out with managing, you know, the Furies. And I said to her, like, what are we going to do? You know, we have this tour book. Debbie can't go. She's like, I know somebody who's a really good musician. She doesn't play drums. She plays guitar. But, you know, she might be willing to learn drums. And so so we got together with this gal. You know, I bought her a drum set at a pawn shop at 6th and Mission.
Are you talking about Janet?
Uh-huh.
I gave her one of her first drum lessons.
Yeah. She learned from you. She learned from this other cat named Bennett, who is also at SF State, a friend of Linda's. We gave her a copy of the album. You know, she practiced for 2 weeks listening to the album and then went on tour with us. And you know what?
Yeah. She's done quite well for herself.
Yeah. The rest is history, huh?
Actually, why don't you tell the listeners who that Janet is?
Yeah, well, Janet Weiss, I mean, she was in that band Sleater-Kinney.
That band.
And a whole bunch of other stuff. Who else was she playing with? I don't know.
Oh, doesn't she play with Motor Goat or something?
Yeah,
she plays
Motor
with
Goat.
Sam up in Portland, yeah.
Yeah, and there's a whole bunch of other bands that she's been in, but I guess she's best known for being in Sleater-Kinney. But that was a very very auspicious beginnings. I'm delighted that somebody from the Furies went on to have a career in rock and roll. You know, that's just, you know, amazes me and is very delightful.
You've mentioned the camaraderie with the music scene and everything, and I totally agree with you and was able to be there to witness that and experience it myself. Do you find, what's the camaraderie like, or when you go to the literary world, what are the relationships like there in comparison to that sort of camaraderie you felt with music?
Well, that's the thing, I guess for me, certainly with the poetry scene in the 90s, that was also a feeling of great camaraderie. Last year at a San Francisco Lit Quake at the Lit Crawl, we had like sort of a Poetry Above Paris Paradise reunion where we, you know, Justin Chen and Thea Hillman and Daphne Gottlieb and just, you know, Taryn Towers. And, you know, we had so many, Mel C. Thompson and John Longy. We had all kinds, and Bucky Sinister and Razor. We had all these people come out and throw down a poem as part of it. And it was just so fun. And it was like, I mean, there were a ton of people there, but you could totally feel the love in the room. Like, people are just so happy to be there and be together and reading poetry together. And so I think that, you know, that was also, you know, with the poetry scene, you know, in the 90s, that was a very, just like, you know, the music scene in the 80s, the poetry scene in the 90s was really, really terrific. And I have to say that with publishing, especially independent publishing, you know, there is a camaraderie. You know, I don't hesitate, you know, calling up or emailing my pal like Johnny Temple from Akashic, or, you know, Richard Nash, who was at Soft Skull for a million years, or Adam Parfrey from Feral House, or, you know, I have, you know, or Elaine over at City Lights. I mean, you know, there's a really good crew of folks who've been, you know, in the game for a long time. And have managed to, you know, make their way and you know, do stuff and stay true to what they started out doing. And, you know, and everybody's picked up a lot of information along the way. And, you know, it's all good. You know, there is still that feeling of camaraderie. You know, and I see folks, you know, at the L.A. Book Festival or the Brooklyn Book Festival, and everybody's, or, you know, South Conference a couple times a year. And people are always glad to, you know, go have a cocktail and, you know, shoot the shit and just be like, how's it going? What's going on? Blah, blah, blah. So, you know, there's still that sense of camaraderie, at least, you know, to a certain extent, you know, with the independent publishing people. And certainly, you know, Razor and Iris Berry, you know, starting Punk Hostage, you know, that's a great, great thing. And, you know, I totally support them, you know, in what they're doing. And they're publishing some great people like Rich Ferguson. So, you know, people are still, you know, when I see people say, okay, we're going to do this, I'm like, right on, go for it. You know? Yeah. So, there is that camaraderie still.
Yeah, we're getting close to the end of our time, but I want to just have you touch on this before we part ways. You know, I saw this really beautiful video online of you and your husband, John Longhi, the poet, your daughter, Phoebe Longhi, who I believe has also published on Manic D Press.
Yes.
I saw you all talking about City Lights books and how you said something really beautiful about you had this, and you mentioned it earlier in the show about having a goal of living within walking distance of City Lights in North Beach, and you talk about your experience with that bookstore and what it's meant to you through the years. I'm curious, what does City Lights represent in the world of books, and what has it taught you about being a book publisher?
Well, you know, City Lights they're strong in every way. They have a super clear vision of what they want to bring into this cultural environment at this point in space and time. You know, they've always been true to their vision of making the world a better place through literature, you know, and that's fiction and nonfiction, you know, putting forth ideas about politics, poetry, and all sorts of things. They also have a very sound business model, you know, so that you can look at them both artistically and from a business standpoint and understand that, okay, this is successful on so many different levels, and the people who work there are just awesome, like so nice and so smart and so not full of nonsense, you know. So, or if they are full of nonsense, it's the same kind of nonsense that I'm full of, so I like them. But you know what I'm saying? It's that dedication to making the world a better place and creating beautiful things in this world that we live in, and I'm all for that. In fact, I try to do that myself, so yeah.
And you do.
Awesome.
And you do. You have such a wonderful roster of writers. We could spend a whole other episode just talking about all the people on Manic D. One that I love dearly, Jeffrey McDaniel.
He's reading this Friday in Worcester, Massachusetts at the Slam there. So if anybody is listening who's in Massachusetts, go see Jeffrey McDaniel this Friday. I'm also going to plug John and Jana. Rules to Break and Happy Punks 1-2-3 are up in Montreal this Friday at the Drawn and Quarterly Library. And Steve Wishnia, When the Drumming Stops, is going to be reading at Pace University next Saturday at 10 a.m. on a panel called Left Wing Noir, all about politics and mystery writing.
And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that book you just mentioned, Happy Punks 1-2-3, accounting book, is catching some nice hell from the Tea Party these days.
Well, actually, it was not the Happy Punks one. It was A Rules to Break, their first book that we put out this winter. Yeah, that was the one that the Tea Party was hating on. And that's when Fun Around the World came in handy, because we sold the rights to a French publisher and a Danish publisher, you know, so that, you know, the whole Manic D point of view is going out across the world in many languages at this point.
Well done,
but yeah,
Jen.
Rules to Break. It was a child's guide to anarchy, and the Tea Party was jumping up and down because it had a blurb on the back from Bill Ayers, who was in the Weather Underground and is a friend of Obama's. So that, you know, they were like, how dare this terrorist and friend of Obama's blurb a children's book? And it's like, well, actually, if you read this book, there's nothing incendiary about it. It's about cooperation, you know, not competition. And, you know, giving away stuff for free as opposed to, you know, embracing the capitalist model of greed being good. So, anyhow. Yeah, that was a very successful book. It immediately went into three printings and seems to have gotten a lot of fans. So, how have you stayed in business? It's like, well, once in a while, we sell some books.
There you go. So where can people find you and Manic D online, Jen?
Well, you know, the Manic D website, manicdpress.com, our Facebook page, also Manic D Press, or Manic D, I think, is the Facebook page, is very active. That lists everything, as well as, you know, often my opinions about stuff. We're also on Twitter, and be in touch. You know, if people want to submit work to Manic D, they go to our website, manicdpress.com, scroll down to the bottom, hit submission guidelines, and follow them, and we'll consider anybody's writing. So there you go.
That's right, but just make sure you read a Manic D book before you submit and tell Jen which one you read.
Well, yeah, because you know what? It has to be self-selecting. You know, the thing is this. If you read a book by Manic D and you hate it, don't submit to us. You know, you'd be amazed at the people. No, Rich, I'm serious. You would be amazed at the people who are like, will read a Manic D book, will hate it, and in their cover letter I read this and I hated it. Here's my manuscript. And it's like, no, if you hated it, there's lots of publishers. Send your work somewhere else. That's the whole thing. It's an editorial viewpoint, you know. And that's the thing. You know, I don't want you to send me something that's exactly like what you just read. But if you thought, you know, if you have the same sense of humor that I do, if you write in a way that creates a feeling, you know, I mean, you know, if you're writing fiction with footnotes, send it to McSweeney's. They publish fiction with footnotes, right? Manic D does
exactly.
Not publish fiction with footnotes. You know, it's whatever. If you write language poetry, send it somewhere else. If you write, you know, narrative poetry, right, lyric poetry, then send us, you know. You don't have to write like Jeffrey McDaniel because only Jeffrey McDaniel writes like a Jeffrey McDaniel. But hopefully you'd have a commanding use of metaphor, right? Anyhow.
Exactly. No. Well, thank you so much for being on the show, Jen.
Yeah, thank you for asking me, Rich, because the truth is, like, you get me talking about, you know, writing. I can, you know, spend 2 hours talking about that. But anyhow, thank you so much, and you know, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about Manic D and what I'm up to.
Well, I love you. You know, I've known you for a while. I love you. I love Manic D, and I just want to support you any way I can. So, yeah. I want to send a big thank you out to our show's sponsor. For all your writerly needs, please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. The show's theme music is by We Voice Sing. Speaking of which, you can find me, Rich Ferguson, online at WeVoiceSing.com, YouTube, Facebook. Next week, my guest will be Tosh Berman, author most recently of the book Sparkstastic, 21 Nights with the band Sparks in London. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape.